Join the Toronto Holocaust Museum and its partners for a community-wide Yom HaShoah commemoration on Sunday, May 5th. A moving evening of film, candlelighting, music, and a tribute to survivors we've recently lost. Keynote speaker Yoni Berus from Yad Vashem will reflect on Holocaust remembrance post-October 7th. The program is at Beth Emeth Synagogue at 7 p.m. Register at torontoholocaustmuseum.org.
Even when he passed away much, much, much too early, his election to have a Jewish funeral was something of a surprise to me.
Hello, bonjour, shalom, and welcome to Culturally Jewish. I'm David Sklar.
And I'm Ilana Zakon.
On this week's episode, we chat with Michael Levine and Jake Yanofsky on the passing of their longtime collaborator and friend, Charles Officer.
Mama always wanted me to be a doctor, but I became an artist and that really shocked her. Now I'm interviewing people in the biz, pros and newish, but all of them are artists and they're culturally Jewish.
This past December, Charles Officer passed away at the age of 48. He was a prolific documentary filmmaker and very well-loved and respected in Canada's artistic community. He directed many award-winning films for CBC and NFB, and on May 4th, Charles is going to be honored by the Hot Docs Documentary Festival in Toronto with a screening of his movie Mighty Jerome. Here today to talk about his life and work, we invited on two of his close friends and collaborators, Jake Yanofsky, who co-founded their production company Cane Sugar Filmworks, and Michael Levine, one of Canada's most prominent literary agents.
Jake and Michael, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
Absolutely.
Jake, maybe we'll start with you. If you could just tell us maybe a brief background about your career and how you first met Charles.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having Michael and myself join you guys here today. It's a real, real pleasure to talk about Charles in this space and in this format. I met Charles in like 2013. I had known about him as a filmmaker and just all around as a great person. He was, especially in the Toronto film and arts scene, he was someone who was very notable and just kind of out there and friendly and engaging. You kind of couldn't ignore him in a space. You know, he was just so present in everything he did. And so I met him when we were both renting office space from a filmmaker named Ron Mann, a documentary filmmaker, kind of a godfather of documentary films in Toronto. And Ron Mann's office was just a great, spectacular space where young filmmakers could kind of meet and hang out and spend time. And I just started chatting with Charles, and as a young producer at that time, I was looking for just a partner, a creative collaborator, and someone that I could connect with and build a career with. And Charles and I really just got to chatting just as peers and friends, and we talked about art, politics, books we liked, movies we liked, and we just kind of swapped tales and stories for a while. Before ever, you know, getting into business together. But really, it just, you know, we started out working as a mutual respect for one another as people. And that was kind of our rule. And I have to give credit to Mr. Michael Levine, who's on this podcast with us, is because he taught myself and Charles, because he was a mentor to both of us, is a mentor, you know, very much to me. It's all about good people before good ideas. And that's what I found in Charles, a good person. And that's why we work together.
Before we start talking about Cane Sugar Filmworks, which I really want to dig into, Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Charles and how your career intersected with his?
Well, I am a recovering entertainment lawyer. I had the privilege of being the entertainment law partner at Goodman's for a few decades. And during the course of that, I was approached by an old family friend you may have heard of named Norman Jewison. And Norman sent me on a mission to grab E.P. Taylor's estate and create the Canadian Film Center. So I had the privilege of going to Mayor Lastman and securing from him E.P. Taylor's estate for $1. What they hadn't told me was that the renovation costs were $5 million. But in any event, at the Film Center. I became involved very deeply, made some charitable contributions through the Brian Linehan Trust, and attended a number of events. And at one of those events, I met a young man who was studying there by the name of Charles Officer. He had already done A Nurse Fighter Boy, and I was his greatest critic. I told him that I thought he had a wonderful visual eye, that he was terrific at character development, but I was a little concerned about the storytelling ability. And from that confrontation, developed one of the great friendships of my life. Of course, Charles, in his early years, apart from being an actor, writer, director, etc., I once told him that he was the only person I knew who, without cultural appropriation, was eligible to star in Raisin in the Sun and Fiddler on the Roof.
I mean, that is very, I would say, very accurate, very true, because if our listeners don't know this already, Charles was born, you know, with a Jamaican Jewish mother and a Christian father, a Black Christian father. Can you tell us, did you ever have conversations with him about maybe what his Judaism meant to him?
Did I ever not have a conversations with him? I have the most spectacular photograph of Charles and I in the bay window of his house, holding Sela, of course, a Hebrew name, his little son. And behind us was what he exhibited in the window, a menorah. Charles' Judaism was important to him, much as I would call my Judaism important, very cultural, very deeply rooted, and yet very open to the world and other points of view, and very tolerant, very understanding. But much to my surprise, and Jake would know more about it than I did, even when he passed away much, much, much too early, his election to have a Jewish funeral was something of a surprise to me. Extremely moving, but I think indicating where his soul was.
Wow. Jake, I could see you nodding along. Do you have any Jewish stories to share about Charles?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And echoing Michael, his beliefs came from such a strong place of tolerance, tolerance for people around him, and seeing the good in people around him, seeing the best in humanity. But he was a very spiritual guy too. You know, there was a spirituality to him. I mean, not that he was like mightily observant, but Charles really liked going home on Friday nights. Like, and the idea of Sabbath and the day of rest was really important to him. And I remember it was a big deal that often Friday evenings was kind of a, I ain't doing anything, you know? And although maybe he wasn't lighting the candles, he was still very much taking stock of the week. And we often talked about the Sabbath and what the day of rest means. And that was really important to him. So it was very interesting to see what little, you know, because, you know, there's many ways to be a Jew, and everyone kind of takes different pieces that mean something to them. But there were these also like sort of ancient pieces of it that he really liked, like the long tradition, the tradition of family. I think he really appreciated also the storytelling aspect of it, because he was so much of a storyteller. I think, you know, every year he would come to my grandparents' house for Passover, and often he'd come for Shabbat dinners. But for Passover, I think it was this incredible narrative that has been passed along for literally thousands of years, the same story that's being told. And for him, you know, as the ultimate sort of storyteller, no matter what media he was in, it was about passing along a narrative. So there were just little things like that that he so was enamored with.
Now, Michael, did his Judaism affect his work at all? Were they ever expressed in his films? Because I think when I was looking into this, you know, a lot of his films were more maybe race-based, based on the Black experience growing up in Toronto or anything like that. Did any of the Judaism ever stream on through?
Well, I would think what he had in common between his two sides, his black side and his Jewish side, is not unlike Jennifer Podemski. I had the privilege of working on a project called Little Bird. Jennifer Podemski's father was victim of the Holocaust. Her mother was victim of the residential school system. Bigotry, intolerance is universal. My buddy Adam Gopnik once wrote an article about the writing of the Old Testament. And when you read about the writing of the Old Testament, it is an episode from Mel Brooks, because you got Shlomi saying this and Harry saying that and Ben saying this. I think what Charles did is he cut through the ideology and he combined a sense of spiritualism and universality with a certain comfort in tradition. But I don't see him, and I guess I'm being very subjective because it's very much the way I feel. To me, the tradition is one thing. The spiritual values are the most important. And it's quite fascinating that the most universal books have sometimes been written by Jews. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, that kind of a book, is very much the kind of feelings that I feel that Charles had. I'm working now with the about the son of the founder of Baha'i. And if you look into the Baha'i religion, you see every single spiritual value that I believe Charles reflected and I would hope I reflect, and which to me is the essence of Judaism. It isn't the ritual.
David, to add to that, I think Charles, obviously, the majority of his films included, you know, protagonists who were Black. There were stories that reflected the Black community. But he himself would always describe what Michael was saying about, I'm choosing something very specific and being incredibly specific, so therefore it becomes universal. And that was really his idea, because it would be unfair to Charles, and Charles would be upset to just be labeled as one thing, that he is just, you know, a filmmaker who only tells stories about Black people. He would say, no, I'm a filmmaker. I tell stories. And these stories can stretch across a range of not only the Jewish diaspora, but any diaspora for that matter. He would say this is, you know, about being accessible to audiences from all walks of life.
Let me give you a sidebar issue about that. The most famous musical in world history is called Fiddler on the Roof. You could not be more obscure than people who dressed in funny clothes, grew their hair funny ways, and got exiled. A Jewish historian flew to Japan and went into the audience on opening night, and at the intermission walked up to a couple who were in their early 40s and said, how can you relate to this shtetl, to these people in funny clothes? And they said, it's our story. It's the universality of intolerance that is reflected. The fact that he chose Black characters instead of Indigenous characters, instead of Jewish characters, it was spiritually, thematically, the same thing.
Jake, in an interview with the CBC, you said Charles will be remembered for saying things that mattered and for taking a stand. And we've just talked a bit about how he used his work to really send strong messages, but was advocacy something that he actually sought out? Was he out there trying to make statements with his work, or it was just part of his storytelling? Can you elaborate a bit on your experience of talking to him about this?
Yeah, I think Charles very much wanted to let the work and the artistry speak for itself. You know, I don't think he had ever, you know, he never had intentions to hit people over the head with messages. You know, that wasn't, you know, he wasn't into making propaganda, basically. He was, you know, an artist through and through. The wonderful thing about his his films, though, is that they often elicited great discussion afterwards, which was wonderful. You know, there could be political discussion, there could be social discussions afterwards, and things that make you question certain things that are happening in society. But he never punched, you know, in his films, right, you know, trying to hit someone over the head. And that was really important. So I think he wanted his film to speak loudly and advocate for stuff. But Charles also, I mean, he wasn't afraid in person to make points or statements. But the wonderful thing is he had this incredible ability to call in, not to call out. So if there were issues to be had, there were conversations to be had. And he didn't want to, you know, lose people. He wanted to gain people. So for him, he always made the effort to have conversations, even with people he might vehemently disagree with, or that he even was possibly hurt by, but to actually try to engage with them to build a relationship and to, you know, mend the world a little bit. I think he, you know, he saw that as a great opportunity to build alliances. He was not about making enemies.
And Michael, you were saying earlier in our conversation that you gave him a lot of constructive criticism in one of his first movies. You sort of said, you know, this is great, but there are places that you can grow. So what was that evolution of his career like from the beginning where you first got to know him to right before he passed away? Did you see it evolve, and where did he leave it at?
Well, there is absolutely no question that it was evolving. And tragically should have had 30 or 40 more years of evolving. The first thing I did with him, you will be very amused, is I called the Premier of Newfoundland, and we were in the middle of making the Republic of Doyle. And I said, you are paying to bring Charles Officer, who's going to be one of our great directors, to shadow direct, because I want him to experience episodic television. And of course, I'm having a love affair with Newfoundland. It's been going on for a very long time. He went out there and he developed from there. But the most significant thing, apart from what everybody knows, Akilah's escape, et cetera, is that I brought in Charles on a project written by the late Mordechai Richler called Son of a Smaller Hero. And I got the first draft written by a very good friend of Mordechai's and mine by the name of Alan Scott. You may not know him, but he happened to write something called The Queen's Gambit.
Oh.
And Alan wrote, you know, a kind of dead-on Mordechai Richler-esque Jewish family in Montreal, relationships with the English and the French, et cetera, et cetera. Along comes Charles, and he takes this project and he turns it into a mixed race family, a Jewish mixed race family. Bell has already invested in it. With Charles' passing, I had to bring in another Black Jew, a young man named Adam Barkin, whose grandfather taught Oscar Peterson to play the piano.
Wow.
And Charles did a wonderful job, and tragically was committed to direct the pilot of this thing. And to me, that will always be my great memory of the evolution of Charles. But he continued to evolve. You know, he had a corkscrew brain. He was a great storyteller. He learned from everybody. He was unbelievably tolerant and yet very clear in his feelings about certain things, certain social values, tolerance, love, etc. And the answer to the question is, he was continuing to evolve and would have continued had he lived 30, 40 more years.
Now, you know, you sort of say everyone knows Akilah's Escape. I never knew about it. I think when I was doing research into this, there was very little I knew about Charles at all. I'd never even heard his name before. And I was thinking, is that sort of the state of Canadian film and productions? Because Charles was a bit critical of it. He sort of said, you know, it's getting more expensive. Things are being cut down. There's maybe two Canadian films that are coming out for the international market. He said in one of his movies, that I even forget the name of it, this was the only Canadian story of a young Black girl ever on the Canadian landscape. So were you having conversations, Jake, with him about the sort of the state of not only Canadian film, but more specifically Black Canadian films as well, too, to sort of say, our stories are not being told. How do we improve upon this? Where are we going in the future? What were those conversations like?
We had plenty of those conversations, and we had, you know, plenty of those conversations together. We've had those conversations with Michael as well and other people. It's the film and TV industry is challenging already. It's also very challenging in a country like Canada. You are sitting above the United States, you know, it's like the giant beneath. So, you know, to create your own lane and your own artistry in Canada is a challenge just by limit of population and by limit of places you can go to receive financing for any project, for that matter, in Canada. But I do think there was an added pressure on Charles and myself when we would produce certain projects together of going, you know, there's often the question, where's the audience? You know, where's the marketing for this? How are we going to get people, you know, into the theaters or in front of their TV screens, especially if we're dealing with subject matters that are new, more diverse, things we haven't seen before? And I think the conversations that it often elicited in myself and Charles was, well, what are our broadcasters, our distributors doing to bring in audiences that they might not typically be bringing in to the cinemas in front of the televisions, reaching different, you know, broad, you know, different amounts of and different types of people to the shows that they create? So that's something we talked about often, you know, how do we enlist that? And it takes a village to make stuff. It's not easy in Canada. It's not easy in the States anywhere. I mean, it's a challenging industry. You know, it's nothing simple about putting together any sort of film or television series. But you have to find the right partners and the right pieces. And the amazing thing is that, you know, Charles was willing to go back to it every single time after each project. With all its obstacles, he would still want to push forward because he was on a mission to make good work and work that shined brightly.
That's a great pivot to talking a bit about Cane Sugar Filmworks. So you co-founded this company with Charles. How did that come to be?
Absolutely. So we sort of rebranded when we started working together, but Charles had come up with the name for a while before I showed up on the scene. But really it came out of that, you know, conversation I was speaking about earlier, when we started meeting, when we were both working in Ron Mann's office, and we really started kind of looking at each other and going, hey, this seems like a good friendship, a good potential partnership. You know, I was very much interested in just the producing side of things. Charles needed that producing partner. He was looking for that consistent professional relationship, and it kind of took off from there. It's important to mention that one of the early projects that we really sunk our teeth into, which Michael was also, of course, like an essential part to, and he really brought it to us, was the feature documentary Invisible Essence, The Little Prince, which was about the book, The Little Prince, the most translated book of all time, and kind of incredibly, Charles is, you know, one of his favorite books as well. I think it had so much meaning to it. And even more wonderfully, Michael, who had been in part of the ballet at the National Ballet of Canada with Guillaume Cote, also made the miraculous discovery that the inspiration for The Little Prince was a Quebecois professor, Professor DeConnick, who we got to be involved in this film as well. And that project really also solidified not only my relationship with Charles and Michael all working together, but it exemplified that pure humanistic energy that Charles showed the world, because The Little Prince is about tolerance and it's about understanding people across cultural borders. And it's about the universality of childhood and the wonder of being alive. And that in itself was such a great cementing thing to build that film together, because it exemplified Charles so much, and it exemplified what I believe in, and I hope I can say this, what Michael believes in. And that's why I think the three Absolutely. Of us got along so well too, was because of that journey of making that film together.
Well, the background of that is that Guillaume Coté, I'm a very good friend of Karen Kane, and had been connected to the ballet forever. And Guillaume Coté came to me and said, I would really like to do a ballet of The Little Prince. Can you help? And I convinced Karen. She said, if you executive produce it, I will do it. Well, from there, through a lot of inquiry, I discovered that when Saint-Exupéry was in exile from Vichy, France, in the war, he was living in New York, and he came to Quebec City to visit a professor, Charles de Kooning. And the model for The Little Prince was his beautiful little 8-year-old son, Thomas de Kooning. And I have many pictures, in fact, in Quebec City, the house where The Little Prince was written, there is a big plaque on the outside that said Saint-Exupéry was here, et cetera, et cetera. And I have a wonderful picture of Charles and I standing there. So what happened is, once I commissioned the ballet, I thought, well, it makes sense that we make a documentary about this. And I approached Charles, and the rest is history. He found this gorgeous little 8-year-old blind Indo-Canadian child who read The Little Prince in Braille, who was the narrator. And Netflix picked it up, et cetera, et cetera. So Charles had a febrile imagination. And let's put it this way. We were very good communicating with each other, because if he had a crazy idea, I had a crazier idea. He had an even crazier idea. And sometimes it actually worked.
You know, we were talking, Jake and I, before we got on to record, about, you know, the difficult times we're facing right now, very divided world right now, particularly sometimes even between the Black and the Jewish communities that have been more strained than ever before, I would say. What do you think Charles would say if he was alive today about the state of the world and how to maybe bring it closer together?
I think he would be absolutely horrified. I always say, those who don't study history repeat it. We feel like Berlin, 1932, and it's tragic. My inspiration, which Charles and I talked about at length, was a cousin of mine who was a Reform rabbi who didn't believe in God, but wore a skull cap because he wanted people to know the Jews stood for social justice. He was a great friend of Martin Luther King, and there is a picture of him picking up a Black girl in Selma in 1965 that won the Pulitzer Prize. Charles and I often discuss that picture. You can find it if you go to Pete Seeger, We Shall Overcome. Literally in the video is that photograph. Charles and I and Jake and all of us are appalled by the current state of the world.
I just wanted to acknowledge that it was devastating for Charles, October 7th. And we actually had some, even though he was quite ill throughout 2023, we had some incredibly sad but very important conversations about Israel and about the state of Judaism, you know, post October 7th. And he was, you know, Charles was intolerant to violence. You know, he was just absolutely a pacifist too, because he was such a lover of people. But it was a very conflicting feeling for him, going back to, you know, we're talking about, I think, your initial question about the Black Jewish relationship. And he was very disturbed, you know, by the fracture in some of these communities. But also he was so sad to see people who he saw as like allies in his work and his life to come out so strongly against Jewish people. And I think very often Charles you know, not everyone knew right away of his Jewish heritage. So they would make assumptions and say things to him that often they didn't even realize they were talking to a Jewish guy. So Charles wore a mug and David his entire life. And sometimes it slipped under his shirt. Sometimes it was above his shirt, but it was always there. And I think people were sometimes startled when they saw that, especially because they had already said stuff to him. So, you know, Charles was like, he was shocked. You know, I think he was really shocked by the hatred he saw towards the Jewish community immediately, you know, after October 7th. On October 8th, he was mortified that yeah. could happen. And it was heartbreaking for him. I wish I had like a better thing to share, but a lot of our last conversations, myself and Charles, were some very heartbreaking conversations about the discomfort of being a Jew. And I mean, it elicited some incredible
yeah.
conversations between us, but they were not happy conversations. So that will forever haunt me a little bit.
Just so we can end on a we did talk a lot about strength and his legacy and creating an environment of tolerance very, very quickly. For our audience who haven't seen any of Charles's films, can you each name a favorite project of his that you would recommend? Michael?
The Little Prince.
And Jake?
A personal favorite of mine, which I don't think gets enough attention actually, is Mighty Jerome. It's about the incredible Olympian track and field star Canada's Harry Jerome. And I think it's a wonderful documentary, an incredible story that you would go, how is this going to be into a film? How are you going to make this into a film? And Charles did it masterfully. So, you know, I'd like to turn people's attention to that one too. But really, all
it's
of
wonderful.
He's wonderful. You can't go wrong.
Jake and Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Our pleasure.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much for hosting us.
Alana, what's happening in the arts world across Canada this week?
So, at the Museum of Jewish Montreal on Thursday, May 2nd, they are doing an opening reception to celebrate the museum's first heritage exhibition at their location in the Mile End called Maxwell Coleman Lessons from the Ordinary. The display is a photographic retrospective of the career of Maxwell M. Coleman, who designed buildings for Montreal's working class, affluent families, and Jewish businessmen and institutions that still stand proudly today. You will recognize a lot of buildings, David, I'm sure, of his in the Mile End. This event sounds really interesting to me as someone who lives in this area and also has history. My grandparents grew up in the Mile End and in the Plateau. So I'm going to try to check this out. And if this is of interest to you, you can check it out on the Museum of Jewish Montreal's website. David, what's happening on your end?
So in Calgary on May 10th at Temple B'nai Tikva, they are inviting Yuval David, an Emmy-winning actor, filmmaker, and advocate on behalf of Israel and LGBTQ causes. He will be speaking on the topic of political homelessness, the challenges today of being Jewish, liberal, and progressive. That sounds quite interesting, and I hope to check it out myself.
In Toronto, on May 9th, from 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, the Miles Nadal JCC presents a film screening of The Wild One in honor of Yom HaShoah. It's an award-winning 2022 documentary which illuminates the journey of Jack Garfine, who was a celebrated Broadway director, Actor Studio West co-founder, controversial filmmaker, and a survivor. You'll learn about his experience in the concentration camps and how they shaped his vision of acting as a survival mechanism and propelled his engagement with themes of violence, power, and racism in two explosive films.
And then heading over to Toronto for an upcoming event for Yom HaAtzma'ut on May 14th, they're inviting you to step into the world of Jewish music from performers from the University of Toronto's Faculty of Music and the Glenn Gould School of Music. In a world very often, as we talk about on the show, dominated by news or politics or even social media, it is a very nice opportunity and a rare opportunity to listen to diverse and vibrant voices from Jewish composers. So that is happening, as I said, on May 14th in the evening, 6:30 to 8:30 in Toronto.
Amazing. David, how was your Passover?
Great. I was very happy to partake. So on the first night, I was invited to a home Passover Seder with a bunch of artists who are Jewish. It was a mixed interfaith Passover Seder, and it was so very unique because the person running it, Tracy Aaron Smith, who I know you know very, very well, she came up with a lot of great, cool ideas. She decided we would do a very condensed version of it, but she used ChatGPT as an aid. So we did the four questions as RuPaul would do the four questions the story of Exodus. And she, you know what? She did something wonderful. She gave us all cards at the beginning to discuss things, to get to know each other a bit better, because a lot of us were strangers and didn't know each other. So we sort of said, you know, what were three important events in your life that shaped who you are as a person? And then it just felt like we were all a bit closer by the end of that Seder.
Wow.
What about you?
Yeah, it's been a lot of great family time. I'm here in Toronto for all of Passover, and I'm spending lots of time with my in-laws and my adorable three-year-old niece. So it's been really, really sweet.
Great. Get to know the whole extended family.
Yeah. Well, we hope you had a meaningful Passover, and we will see you again in a couple of weeks.
Take care, everybody.
Culturally Jewish is hosted by me, David Sklar, and
Ilana Zakon.
We're produced and edited by Michael Freeman, and our theme music is by Sarah Siegel-Lazar. We're a member of the CJN Podcast Network. To support our work and everything the CJN does, visit the cjn.ca/donate to make a monthly donation and receive a charitable tax receipt.
Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.